the thing the Senate Committee did up to now.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to...
Glad to hear that you have some comments here, sir.
I'd like to ask Roger to explain, the definition of the word statement.
I was afraid you were going to ask me the second part of that.
Yes, and then this, obviously, we're into this in either two or three. And specifically, I would like to know some examples of the latter part of the definition.
Statement, that means any representation of fact.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
And includes...
He says the light was green.
A representation of opinion, belief, or other state of mind. Where the representation clearly relates to state of mind, apart from or in addition to any facts which are the subject of the representation.
I ask you, what is your opinion?
Well, I suppose a classic example would be, I don't remember. Or I don't know.
No, suppose that you have the example, you got a doctor understand, you ask him what his opinion is. Gives an opinion. You allow his report to be given to somebody else, which is diametrically opposed to what he tests on to stand.
Well, but I'm not, what you're saying is that the doctor gets on the stand and says, in my opinion, the injury is permanent. And they haul out his letter, which he wrote last week, and he said, in my opinion, there's no permanence.
There's deposition.
Or deposition, whatever. But I don't see where that fits into this description.
Well, you have three different situations here: opinion, belief, and state of mind. One I suggested was state of mind, and one John suggested was opinion.
Well, now, how does... We know that's a representation of an opinion. He says, in my opinion, the injury is permanent. Now, does that representation of opinion clearly relate to a state of mind apart from or in addition to any facts which are the subject of the representation? Frankly, I don't understand it. Maybe that's why I
had trouble with this before.
I don't mean to be critical, but I frankly don't. Yeah. That's why I'm asking you.
Another example would be if a witness were asked, did he remember seeing so-and-so at a party on a particular evening? He'd say, no, I have no recollection of seeing that person there. And you can prove that he, in fact, did see him and make many statements to that effect.
Wouldn't that be...
Now, his representation would be to his state of mind, I don't remember, for example, rather than such as distinguished from the fact of whether the person was there or not. He wouldn't be saying that the person was there or wasn't there. He would be saying, as a matter of his state of mind, he doesn't recall whether they were there or not.
Frank Costello guy was...
Well, I suppose they're all forms of basic answers. I don't remember. I don't recall.
Well,
I don't know.
Best of all, I don't remember. Well, that seems to me to present a policy question. I'm not sure that I'd be ready to spur the DA onto every I don't remember witness.
Well, isn't this doing what George was saying, just a statement of policy that you don't lie in court?
Well,
actually, aren't we really saying there needs any representation of the fact? Isn't the state of mind the fact?
Well, you've got a lot of cases.
Well, again, Frank, what district attorney is just going to capriciously prosecute people or something? It just isn't going to be done.
I think he's referring to Gray County.
Well, if you don't have it for several years, you have a situation, Jim, where a witness takes a stand and knows what you're doing. He just says, I don't remember. Smile at him. Ask him, and I don't remember. Is he immune? Is he out from under the law? Is he been subpoenaed? Is he under oath?
Well, he should. The law, is the law in Oregon now, or the law generally now, that his hypothetical would be a good defense?
What was the hypothetical? You know he knows the facts, he takes the stand, and you ask him a question, and he states, I just don't know.
Is that perjury?
I doubt whether under existing Oregon law, is that...
Would it be perjury under this?
Yes. If you could prove it. By independent evidence, the fact that he did know.
And you'd have to bring in a psychiatrist to testify to the reasonable medical probability that he did remember at that time rather than having
it
lapse.
That would be a representation of his state of mind. That would be distinguished from the subject of what he was asked.
Yeah, I mean, you'd still be required to prove that it was false.
You'd have to prove
it was
false.
And that he knew
it
was false.
Right.
When he said it. Now, the original form of this, in preliminary draft number one, read, statement means any representation, but includes a representation of opinion, belief, or other state of mind only if the representation clearly relates to a state of mind apart from, or in addition to any facts which are the subject of the representation. And in the subcommittee, Mr. Johnson urged that subsection 2 be amended by adding a fact after representation. Mr. Carson suggested that and be substituted for but, so that it would read, statement means any representation of fact. Well, it's the same as we have now. So this was restructured, but I don't think to any extent that it changed the substance of that.
The present Oregon law, the perjury, included in the perjury statement, declaration of opinion.
Oh, no, I don't.
Where I collected the perjury statement, yeah.
I think
that's
right.
The outcome.
No, it just says, in regard to any material matter or thing. Is that not right?
No matter or thing.
Well, what kind of wondering is, if we get an area of opinion, only certain people are entitled to give opinions, and only if they have some basis of expertise to make their opinion admissible. And if you're going to put a doctor in a situation saying, in my opinion, the injury is or is not permanent, or my diagnosis, therefore, opinion is this, which is materially outcome of a civil case, you're putting it in line for a perjury rap if his opinion was proven wrong.
Jack, Sam.
I should feel he's been bribed. He took out of the bribery statute.
He's his representative.
Let's go to the bribery.
I thought that everybody can testify to his opinion as long as it's within his knowledge, as long as he has ability to. In your opinion, was the guy running? Anybody can testify. You don't have to be a doctor.
No, that's not an opinion, that's a fact.
But you don't have to be an expert to testify as to the value of property.
In your opinion, was he hurrying?
The speed of a car.
Is it a bad Mark Floyd? Doesn't anybody, see things of this kind? Not limited to a PhD.
The thing is, the difference between a statement of opinion and a statement of fact is a completely blurred situation. Matters in the middle, which partake of each characteristic, and non-expert witnesses testify to them all the time.
Well, as I understand it, we were almost ready to approve Section 2 when Judge Burns objected to the definition of statement.
I didn't object.
He didn't object to it.
Explained.
Well, were you satisfied with the explanation?
Of Sub 2?
Well, of sub no, of statement. Sub 3.
I must confess I still don't understand. I'm sorry, but I don't want to hold up the proceedings of the commission.
If the other 8 are doing that, you're satisfied.
If there's an example, don't read statute in the commentary.
Well, let's go ahead and vote on perjury on section 2, and I rather suspect we're going to have to...
Subsection 2.
Yeah. No, I'm talking about section 2 on page 6.
We haven't even got those sections.
No, we're going to come back to the definitions last, Bob.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, we haven't... All right. We're discussing section 2 in connection with two words in it.
Involves statehood.
Yeah.
And involves
material.
You better hammer those two out. Because I don't think that the definition of statehood is the problem.
You don't think that... Well, what was your substitute for it, Dave?
Well, I think that the Oregon... What was the wording? Matters.
Well, any person who... swears or affirms falsely in regard to any material matter or thing.
Well, I don't think it's good wording, but I think it gets to the fact that you exclude opinion and belief. And this is what bugs me. Well, opinion is admissible only because someone has some basis of expertise upon which to draw a conclusion, the ultimate fact. And that's why they do allow it from an expert.
No, you could.
There are other opinions of Dave that are given in trials that aren't
opinion
expert
as
opinions.
To speed in an automobile accident case. Driver.
If you're yes, if you drive an automobile, you might have foundation for that as well. This isn't just something. You can't ask a 5-year-old kid how fast to speed was.
All right, Dave.
Probably a foundation for it. But when you get into its areas of opinion, if you say opinion for speed, opinion of distance is the same as opinion for, well, it's your responsibility of insanity. They're all opinions. They all come into this subject. And I don't think it should be that. It should be matters of fact. The man who falsely swears I saw John Doe on August 4th, 1969, shoot. And that's false. That's a fact he's testifying to. He ought to be hung, but not the guy who says
it. Falsely says I
did. Well, one who says it, I interpret the x-ray as indicating a compression fracture of L5.
And it doesn't.
And it doesn't. Well, but we get three rated out and just look at it and say, yes, it's a hairline fracture, and then say, no, it's a...
The only way you're going to get a doctor treatment is just in this case, the doctor gets up and does it testify to a certain condition exists. And you've got all of the report she sent to somebody else in which she says just the opposite. I mean, in other words, he's no more given his opinion. He's lying up there. Because he's been paid to lie.
Or say he's...
There's an old phrase, but that goes to the weight, not to... So you can impeach the witness on the basis he made a prior...
Well, the point is, well...
Don't teach him not to do it again.
Does he have any right to get up there when he knows dang well that this condition doesn't exist? To get out there and just coldly lie about it, than your other example that I saw John X shoot John Jones on such and such a day. Neither one of them had any more right to get up there and just coldly lie about it.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Well, that's the spectrum. The other side is on cross examination when you say to the doctor, now you testify to such and such. That's your opinion, isn't it? This is the last one of the facts in the case. The doctor, that's not it. I asked you what your opinion was. You're an expert. If I look at your opinion, you're testifying here today. Now, is that your opinion that shows so-and-so? Well, I've already given my testimony. Yeah. The circumstances were such that it indicated to me, yes, probably that was. What's your opinion, isn't it? Yes, that's my opinion. Okay, now but he's given his opinion. If it's bad, he'll be guilty of perjury.
No.
Period.
Not unless he knows
it. Well, if it's wrong, and he's an expert, therefore he knows it's wrong.
No, it's not a question of being wrong, it's a question of being false.
Yeah, it's a question of lying.
In the area of opinion, that's like duty. It's in the eye of the beholder. He lies, yes, he lies, no.
Oh, no, but Dave, that you know as well as I do, that indeed it seems to me there's anything, because you're talking about a witness who was usually paid to testify.
Wasn't the doctor paid to testify?
Right. If he just made a statement out in the hall, that he really felt some other way and then went in, that would be perjury. He's up there, why? He doesn't hold this opinion. He's saying that he's given an opinion which he does not hold.
And he later tells somebody, I really screwed that jury up. I told them that it was a permanent injury, and it wasn't. And they returned a big verdict. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
You open it up for that case, great, but how about the extreme case? And that's what you're including also.
Well, if we could all have undivided attention.
Everybody.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, I think you'd have first attention against everybody in any trial. The balloons and dots are always being brought to the trial.
You don't bring it. I bring stress to the room.
Why did you bring it all against the plaintiff's witnesses?
We had a situation for even under the present statute for a while every time the jury refused to believe a witness, the district attorney bring a perjury charge on time.
Where was it?
In our time. It's a couple of years ago. Every time the witnesses come up and appear in the trial and for the defense and the guy would get convicted while all the defense witnesses got cited for perjury.
Well, that's lovely.
If we could have your undivided attention, that Judge Burns is going to think out loud.
Boy, what an introduction. You could cut the Ed Sullivan hour down to 10 minutes with introductions like that. Well, the only example, however, that Roger has so far suggested is when the witness says, I don't remember, and you know the son of the gun actually remembers. Now, is that a representation of opinion, belief, or other state of mind, where the representation clearly relates to state of mind apart from any facts which are the subject of the representation? I still do not see how that description fits the I don't remember. What facts are the subject of the representation?
Whether he was there or not there.
Whether he remembers seeing the victim.
He's asked if he were at a certain place at a certain time, and he says, I don't remember. His answer represents a state of mind apart from the facts, which are the subject of representation, the subject being whether he was there or whether he was not there.
How do you get inside his mind to prove beyond a reasonable doubt and to a moral certainty that at that particular moment in history he actually didn't remember?
You might have a problem there.
Well, what you do is you get a hold of a testimony that the day before he conversed with a number of people and said, related all the events that happened.
But what if
that I was there and all that type of
thing. What if he had psychomotor epilepsy and he just had a momentary lapse of memory?
Well, it says something in the hall outside the courtroom. I'm going to go in and tell him I don't remember.
It's a tough case to prove, then, that you got him in, but I think we get the guy who was just.
Okay.
The Costello, who just sitting there.
Was the doctor then?
Where are you supposed that in those cases it will be? It's probably a significant opinion one to be there.
Well, you ready to vote on section 2?
Yeah.
I want to. Can I get a road vote? Can I get a law lesson from somebody? Why is it?
You won't get us to raise that here.
We've forgotten all the laws.
Well, this is the definition. Whether it's a false statement of material, given the factual situation is a question of law. That means the judge makes a decision. Why? Why?
Why, Roger?
Well, I think the rationale is that the judge is better able to evaluate the importance of a statement in the context of the case in which it was made.
Why single this one out? Because almost any other statements made during the court of trial are fair, but there will be a reason to tell how it's important or not.
You would be having one side would call 68 witnesses, so all the attorneys in town that agreed on it. One side calling and say this was the material in this case, and you have said be calling all kinds of witnesses, and the jury would be in a whole.
Oh, yeah. You might analogize it this way. If you are a witness. You say
light was red, and I saw that red car go through it. And I attempt to impeach you by citing an inconsistent statement that you previously made on a collateral matter. The court will make a decision that the matter on which you sought to be impeached is collateral and therefore stopped it. He's making a ruling of law. It isn't left to the jury whether or not you can impeach in that area. Left to the court. A lot of rulings of law that the court makes during the course of the trial. Which, in one sense, the word invades the jury's problem.
Well, you asked that question, Bob, because in our last subcommittee meeting, we discussed this some great length concerning similar provision in another section, and we kicked it out and felt that that we should reserve the determination of that particular issue in the province of the jury. Is that not right, Don?
Well, I'd have to. I think that's right, that we did finally take it out. I've just got the first draft here in this volume. I'd have to check the subcommittee minutes.
Okay. Well,
I'm sure whether we took it out. That was on the question of choice of evils, whether or not that it amounted to justification, and we're going to provide the court the rules matter of law, whether the facts. If the facts were established, they would amount to a justification as a matter of law.
Are y'all pretty much convinced that it would promote justice to let the judge decide materiality as a matter of law? I can't speak for Bruce Balding on this, but...
Another example where it's like in the Blue Sky security state, the court determines whether or not it's security, because the jury could hear all kinds of testimony for 3 or 4 days, and the jury would be all confused.
Well, the prosecutors and defenders around here think it's right. Far be it from me.
Let the jury decide materiality when there are facts upon which the defendant can be convicted. The defendant is put in a disadvantage, and he doesn't know whether the jury was influenced by this material factor or not in reaching its decision of guilt. His right of appeal is thereby practically foreclosed. And I'm trying to think of a couple of analogies where that now happens or did these again. Well, involuntary confession situations. The judge determines whether the confession is voluntary rather than letting it go to the jury to determine that. And if he determines it's involuntary, it's out, the jury never hears it. The situation, if the jury gets that,
but
then
the jury still decides on whether or not it's voluntary.
Yeah, that's right. But if it's an involuntary one, the jury never gets it. So the defendant gets a chance to appeal that particular issue.
Except in some departments.
Well, I think that's fine. But this situation obtains for allowing the court to do that. Rather than complicating, we have to preempt the defendant later on the appeal.
Will we approve section 2?
Okay, the motion is that we approve section 2 as it's drafted. All in favor, say aye as your names are called. Those opposed, no.
Mr. Chairman, is this section 2 or subsection 2?
This is section 2 on page 6.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Yes.
Rask?
Oh. We have yet to decide what the word material means or the use of the word statement means. Am I right?
That's right. But we're going to, after we go through these 8 sections, we're going to come back to the definitions.
Right.
Following your original suggestion.
I can't vote on section 2 of perjury unless I know what the word statement means. And
you want to abstain?
I don't know.
Okay.
Haas?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Aye. Carried section 3.
Well, before we go on and compound our issues, I suggest that we go back and take the definition section at least in context of section 2.
Well, that's fine with me, except I thought you wanted to go through each section, and that's why
we... Until we hit the problem and discuss it in context with the section.
You're going to move that we reconsider the action by which we formerly followed your recommendation.
Is that a statement of belief?
Yeah.
State of mind, state of opinion, mind. But apart from the set of facts.
We got the question out in front of us on this move that we tentatively adopt definition of material, definition of state in section 1.
Well, we've got to go back to get benefit. Receiving a benefit.
Well, benefit won't apply to section 4.
Well, the way we did it, we adopted Bob's motion to amend sub 1 to include the definition of benefit. And then we were voting on his motion to put in pecuniary benefit in sub 2, and you objected to it. Now, if you want to restate that motion, and we'll take them in order.
Well, why don't we just take sections of section 1?
We've had to
come to grips with the problem of what material and statement.
Okay, we now have material and statement. Benefit we have yet to hit. Benefit in section 4. That was what I was talking about. Let's just take them up as they come up.
All right.
I don't know if we adopt definition materials contained in section 1, sub 2, as present stands.
All right. Heard the question. Everybody in favor, signify aye as your names are called. Those opposed, no.
And this is subsection 1 of section 1, right?
No,
section 2 is section 1.
Subsection 2.
As presently numbered.
As presently numbered.
Material.
That's there.
Definition.
All right, Judge Burns? Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Yes.
Frost?
Aye.
Paz?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Passed.
I'll make the same motion with regard to the statement.
All right. Heard the motion. Everybody in favor of...
Aye.
The motion signify aye. Your name is called. Those opposed, no.
The motion before.
You have questions for me.
Question, I have an opinion.
You have a statement of mind.
Which is that I don't think we have any business putting the words opinion, belief, or the state of mind in the definition of statement as it relates to section 2 of perjury. For the reasons which I have some feeling with the state of mind.
Do you want to move to amend his motion?
I would move to amend the motion by leaving from sub 3 the definition of statement. The words "and includes a representation of opinion, belief, or other state of mind."
Just everything afterwards.
No. That's it. And then so it reads, statement means any representation of fact where the representation clearly relates. Okay. Statement means any material representation of fact. Let's draw in sub 2.
You want to just put a period after
don't
the fact?
Period after.
Now, listen to this. Representative Frost moves to amend Mr. Johnson's motion by putting a period after fact in sub 3 of section 1 and deleting the rest of the subsection. Now, everyone in favor of Representative Frost's motion, say aye as your names are called. Those opposed, no.
Judge Burns?
No.
Chandler?
No.
Clark?
No.
Frost?
Aye.
Pot?
No.
Johnson?
No.
Knight?
No.
Young?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
Can we form a club?
You got two down.
I don't get all
question
on the main motion.
Question on the main motion. All in favor of the main motion, say aye as your name should call those folks. No.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Yes.
Frost?
No.
Paz?
Aye.
Johnson.
Aye.
Knight.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Aye.
And now what you wish, what are the rest of the questions?
I think we'll make the same motion on the sworn statement, but I'd like, I'll make that motion, but I'd like to make a comment.
Sorry.
It's quite a discussion, but it's a subcommittee. Am I correct, comment that the law today does not apply to the statement being approved here, this would include any notarized statement?
Given under oath. Yes.
We have false.
What does the law apply to today?
This would apply to driver's license application.
No. Perjury is only a great, great trial.
Well, that's, well, this is false swearing.
False swearing is anything in notary, it'd be false swearing.
Yeah. Anything under oath.
This definition, that's what I'm trying to point out, I don't think the committee is aware of this, as I understand it, is it far broader than present law? Basically, any affidavit, anything that has to be notarized, because if you read the notary, that's kind of.
But so is.
It's supposed to be under oath.
So is false swearing today, though.
Oh, what's a felony?
Well.
That's where you want to say, I swear to God, you don't want to swear.
So I affirm, they give you an affidavit.
It does not apply.
Like an oath, when you're a juror or a witness.
Perjury does not apply today to a non-court statement, does it?
No.
Extrajudicial statement, that's called.
Well, didn't you put this definition in here to cut out the business of having to put swears or affirms in the regular perjury statute?
You're talking about oath or affirmation?
Well, we had quite a discussion, we finally decided to make it all inclusive, we didn't see that there was any distinction.
Whether it's in court or out of court.
But the idea of policy decision, many ought to be aware of.
Well, then what we're doing is muddying up the waters, and we're departing from the traditional concept of perjury and including a lot of other things within it, aren't we?
Mm-hmm. I don't think that's what he said.
Well, scratch that.
To me, perjury is in the court.
Well, you see, as original, preliminary draft number one had 2 degrees of perjury, first degree and second degree, and we defined the word official proceeding, which would include your trial type thing. First degree perjury was perjury committed in an official proceeding. Second degree perjury was perjury committed in any other situation other than an official proceeding. The trouble is, decided on subcommittee that wasn't necessary.
Actually, though, you're mistaken to some extent. There are an awful lot of statutes in our code today which make a notarized statement false, make it perjury. Your statutes would say violation of this state statute constitutes perjury.
Teacher certification is a case point.
You've got other non-judicial things in here. You've got the nature of false report has to do just with the police or fire. This one is non-judicial.
Right, but of course that doesn't involve a sworn statement under oath.
No.
Well, now certainly the way I read 162.110, our present perjury statute, that's not limited to trials.
No. Only the penalty makes that distinction.
Yeah, but that could cover a statement given, a sworn statement given to a notary. Or an out-of-court statement could be perjury. It's just a question of how it's punished.
Right. Right? It's required by law, and the oath is given. It's notary public.
So, really, I don't think we're really changing present law all that much.
I don't think we are either, but there is, I think it is a little bit broader.
Well, you weren't objecting to it, Lee. You were just pointing out.
No, I thought it should be pointed out, because I think it was all kind of rushed over.
Well, does anybody have any other questions, Senator? He's made the motion to approve it.
The only question I have is just to clarify in my own mind, affirm would be the equal level as an oath. Not a letter written to a license bureau saying, don't send me a license because I
know this. That's a statutory procedure for an equivalent affirmation. Morris, chapter 444.
This is an agnostic so.
Okay. Well, everybody in favor of Mr. Johnson's motion to approve section 4 or sub 4 as presently numbered, say aye as your names are called.
Judge Bennett. Briggs?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Yes.
Frye?
Aye.
Claus?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye.
Harry, now, before we... Before we leave this, then, Bob, make your other two motions so that the record will be clear, and we'll have the definitions at least tentatively approved. Yes, Dave?
The point I made before is the word benefit, if we're going to have a motion to use, the definition of benefit applies only to section 1.
All right.
Why would you...
That's okay.
We already approved benefit, it's just pecuniary benefit and public service.
Yeah, that's right, but we'll come to that at section 4. We're on section 3 then, Roger, false swearing. A person commits a crime of false swearing if he makes a false sworn statement knowing or having reason to know if to be false.
There are two differences in this statute from the basic perjury statute. One is it doesn't have to be in regard to a material issue. Two, notice on knowing or having reason to. Section 2 perjury requires actual knowledge. Section 3 implied knowledge.
I wonder if the actual effect of that would be to get the prosecution to a jury a lot more easily than a false swearing case than previously would be the case.
You get to a jury more easily than you can now.
Yeah, I take it that what you intend to do is to expand the definition so that you need not prove knowledge, but only the likelihood of knowledge. Kind of like you're receiving a sealing statute presently, where you know or have good reason to know that you're good on the score and so on.
I'm greatly disturbed when I go to watch a court proceeding, number of statements that people make under oath that are lies. You have two people testifying to exactly opposite things. One of them's got to be lying.
You're lying. That's what
I don't agree with.
I'm lying.
One of them might be lying, but
one of them could just be mistaken.
That's what you have reason to know.
Well, if he's heard the other guy testify just to the opposite about 3 9
not
before, he's got a pretty darn good reason to know.
The reason for this laid out at the top of page 9 is something that is useful. The perjury section requires actual knowledge of the falsity statement, while the false swearing section requires either actual or implied knowledge of falsity statement. This distinction was made to make it clear that the crime of perjury involves an intentional, knowing misstatement. False swearing offense, which goes to a collateral rather than a material issue, may be predicated upon a reckless disregard of the truth. It also gives the state a plea bargaining alternative, where it's obvious that the statement was false, but they might be more difficult to prove actual knowledge, where there would be evidence available to prove implied or constructive knowledge.
Roger, the present Oregon law restricts false swearing to willful knowing.
Yes.
So basically, false swearing is the same as perjury.
Yeah.
Has to know it was false.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I assume if you urge the plea bargaining aspect, there's a couple of votes that I can see here.
Well, actually, you say have reason to know. Actually, when you prove knowingly, you usually rely on evidence, which you draw the inference that you knew it.
But it would be easier to get to the jury on having reason to know than knowing.
I'm not sure I want to go that far.
You'll notice this, the one Oregon case in point, although it involved perjury rather than false swearing, is State versus Smith.
Page 9.
Page 9. and they would give some support to the element of implied knowledge. Show that he knew them to be false, or that he stated them under such circumstances that knowledge of falsity could would be imputed to him.
Representative Haas has it.
I move we strike the section 3 on this week.
Have you heard the motion? Representative Haas moves to amend section 3 by striking the words or having to know on line 3. Or having reason to know. Ready to vote? Everyone in favor of the motion to amend, say aye as your names are called.
Judge Brand?
Aye.
Chen?
No.
Clark?
No.
Frost?
Aye.
Haas? Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
No.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Law and order is a house divided?
No. Pass.
Why? For it.
It all depends on how long you.
Let's take a 5-minute recess. Wait a minute. Does somebody want to make a motion to pass the section now? Representative Haas moves that we approve section 3 as amended. All in favor say aye as your name is called.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Frost?
Aye.
Haas?
Aye.
Johnson?
Johnson?
Johnson votes aye.
Knight?
Yeah.
Oh, aye.
Aye.
Aye. Take it. During the noon hour, Roger will prepare a new commentary on bribery, and they've passed out copies of it to everybody. If you just look at it and find it to be in order, we could approve it and it'd be
so moved,
amended into our commentary. General Johnson.
PSC Burns called your question.
All right. So, Attorney General Johnson has moved that we adopt the addendum to commentary. Everybody in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. So ordered. Section 4. You know, Roger's picked learn fast. You get a lot more confidence late in the afternoon than you do in the morning, don't you?
Save the tough one for later sections.
Yeah. Okay. Unsworn falsification.
Person commits a crime of unsworn falsification if he knowingly makes any false written statement to a public servant in connection with an application for a pecuniary or other benefit. So we're talking about a statement that isn't under oath. It's written, submitted to a public servant, submitted in connection with an application for any type of benefit, as defined in section 1.
This is regard to.
Can I ask you what all the ORF
is? A false statement and an application for a fish or a game license.
These all be repealed.
They're not part of the earbuds.
I think they'd have to be examined. Most of them would be repealed. The only ones that might not be, if they were didn't involve, you could construe them not to involve a benefit. But I would think any license, for example, would definitely be a benefit.
One of your sections is the income tax return, don't you? Don't you? That doesn't have to put that on, of course. Now, this one statement, there's your affirmation on the bottom of your income tax return.
Yes, both federal and state.
Yeah.
This would also apply to a person submitting a written testimony to legislative action, right?
Filling out these per diem slips.
May I have mine back? I spent 10 cents less on one.
What the 58 times 8 or whatever?
There is a multiplication count.
Well, now, Dave, put your objection to benefit in the context of this section so that I can understand.
Okay, reading section 4, I don't have that. To the definition of benefit implies and put back in the driveway.
So I understand this is a misnomer, right? The main purpose is to be able to put it on the form.
But it isn't.
You don't have
it. No, I don't. It's extremely broad. I think it covers the letter addressed to Department of Labor to get a
barber's
license or an elevator permit or whatever it might be.
If he knowingly makes
very
a false and deadly statement.
Is it good drafting to say pecuniary or other benefit? If we intend to include non-pecuniary benefits, why do we not say applicable for a benefit?
Yeah. For any benefit. Yeah.
And Judge Burns moves to delete a pecuniary or other and to insert the word in, was that right?
I also would like to ask a question in connection with this. It seems to me that we are creating a whole host of new crimes, a whole host of situations in which person's activity will now be subject to criminal prosecution. I certainly can't quarrel with the statement that deception in official matters creates an equally impermissible interference with the proper administration of government, but we have gotten along so far reasonably well. We're only doing this in certain selected areas, the election agencies and whatnot. And with the range of government activity getting what it is to be, and all sorts of things, I want us to realize that we're swooping into the criminal net a lot of activities and a lot of things that haven't been there before. And in one sense of the word, this is somewhat contrary to the overall general purpose of criminal law revision.
Our special reason of charge.
I mean, originally we were supposed to simplify and cut down and so forth and so on.
Comments. First, I think if you don't have a general statute like this, you're going to end up drawing them in, and you're going to end up with some of them being felonies and some of them being misdemeanors. Secondly, this is a misdemeanor. I understand it would be essentially a misdemeanor.
Or a violation. Petty
misdemeanor. And it is a matter that it gives the government agency something they can print on a form to advise people that it is.
There'd be administrative discretion, district attorney's discretion. There'd be a lot of discretion in the application of this board. I just can't visualize why application of the statute.
It's a handle that can be used very nicely by a lot of people who want to use it. This is a point. True area where it's relying on prosecutor discretion.
For administrative discretion, what agency heads going
to
bring on minor?
More important than that he'd be able to put on his form.
Yeah.
That's what he agreed with. You know.
So he can revoke your nurse's license if it turns out you're alive without going to any further.
Well, just by putting on the form, people can clearly see it on the form.
Yeah. Or wouldn't allow the same thing.
You mentioned tax law. We're talking about tax fraud.
We have a draft on the seat.
Yeah, and if you obtain property as a result of this some deceptive statement. You know, maybe that would not be theft by deception.
The property owner wouldn't be a job or a license.
Well, this statute, of course, is designed primarily to act as a deterrent. In other words, to discourage people from making a false statement in the first instance. They receive these benefits on the basis of false information. They're be chargeable under some other statute.
Well, let me ask a question. I'm thinking of a guy that I prosecuted who's been convicted 8 times for drunk driving and 7 times for reckless driving. And then they just homicide and other stuff. In Washington, came into Oregon and made out an application for an Oregon driver's license and falsified it in that he said he'd never been convicted of a crime elsewhere. And that was one instance in which the Marion County District Attorney refused to prosecute him.
That was the old and the only.
Yeah, well, maybe. There is a specific statute making it a misdemeanor to falsify an application for a driver's license. Now, and presumably we are going to repeal that by adopting this. Now we enact this general statute. Would Frank, when brought a case, when a case of that nature is brought to him, have an option to go to one or the other?
Why would you repeal the other?
Well, I don't know. I thought you just said
no. I would assume, for example, in cases of licenses, and this list I have is not all inclusive. There are many others throughout the regulatory. Would repeal all those?
It would repeal them all.
A license being a benefit.
All right.
I think that's very desirable, John.
I do. Providing that we're going to do that. Mm-hmm. All right. I'll buy that.
You know, let me throw a chilling thing. One of the things that we were talking about yesterday was this discretion of district attorney. One of the problems with election law is at least our district attorney in Marion County argues that he has no discretion, that he must, in fact, enforce under penalty of failure or losing his office or being punished for a crime himself. I just wanted to point out, did we finally resolve that? Is that number 6 that we didn't?
That's yesterday.
That's yesterday in the subcommittee. But you're going to get questioned very shortly whether we want to make it a crime for a district attorney to go to sleep on the job when it serves his purpose. Now, we might say discretion of the district attorney, or you might say corruption. It's an interesting argument, and be careful, because this is the problems we have. If you give this discretion, we better not make any crime for his failure to enforce to the very letter of the law.
But it isn't the DA that even exercises discretion in this field, it's the administrator.
Well, we were anxiously awaiting to hear what the prosecution-oriented people would have to say. I don't know where I'd be.
You don't want to be tied down. No, I don't think it's proper to tie me down.
Well, that's a part, and I didn't mean to
reason that,
but don't take any comfort, or your comfort will be pulled away shortly, because leaving into the discretion of the district attorney, we're going to confront that issue directly soon.
Okay. Well, Judge Burns has a motion then to amend this by again striking the words a pecuniary or other benefit or other on the last line and inserting any. Everybody in favor of that motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. That's your pleasure.
May I ask another question? Suppose that I am arrested and taken to the police station, and the police officer says, "Do you wish to make a statement about this matter after giving the advice?" And I say, "Yes." He said, "Well, why don't you write it out?" So I write out an exculpatory statement, and I applied for a benefit. Why not?
I don't think you have in connection with an application for a benefit.
Yes, it is.
Sure.
Why is it?
In that case, for a benefit, the benefit is you won't go to jail if you believe it. That's a pretty good benefit.
Could you ever get, would a statement ever be qualified or constitute an application under it?
You're applying for a gain or an advantage.
You bet.
Pursuant to your desire.
I want to get out of jail.
Long maintenance for your business.
Well, then he might beat the rap on the original charge, you give him for making a false.
Well, I just know any number of people that would sign a complaint, put a detainer on a guy for making a false statement or circumstances like that, where the main charge may have been kicked out.
Don't you think that if the instruction I suggest is correct, don't you think that there are many police officers who would be delighted to find the existence of this section?
I think Section 8 here is much more alarming if you're worried about things like that than this one. However, I don't see that the police misusing this one either. You had the same arguments on the mental illness, notice mental illness, and the police were just going to indiscriminately go out and do this. Well, it hasn't worked that way. We haven't had them using this in lieu of criminal charge.
As far as the first guy making an exculpatory statement and being charged under this one, that would mean that every defendant who got on the stand and said, I didn't do it, was convicted, would also be indicted for perjury. How many actually are those? But the same thing would apply.
We'll cover that in a later section.
Yeah, we'll come to that.
Move to approve Section 4 as amended.
Okay, there's a motion to approve Section 4 as amended. Everybody in the room, say aye as your name is called. Postpone the round.
Actually, well, I'm all in. No.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Ross?
No.
Haas? Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Young?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
No.
Section 2.
Okay.
Read subsection 2. Pecuniary benefits upon the money, property, commercial interest, or economic gain, period.
Referred Mr. Chandler's motion to amend Section 1. Did you get it, November? Restate it, Bob.
Pecuniary by new Section 2, subsection 2, saying pecuniary benefit means a benefit in the form of money, property, commercial interests, or economic gain, period. Same as on page 1 of the primary of influences thing, you know, without the reference to our chapter 6.
Okay, I've heard the motion.
Are you adding benefit as well,
Bob? I already added benefit.
Well, we no longer have the word benefit. Pecuniary or other benefit.
We no longer have pecuniary benefit.
We don't need another, we don't need any pecuniary.
Jim Burns' motion was
just any benefit.
Or a pecuniary or other benefit is out.
So any benefit. And all we need is a definition and a public servant.
And benefit.
We already have.
And all we need is public servant.
I move that we have a new Section 2 and renumber the following sections. Definition of public servant be that. We approve the article on private and corrupt influences.
In other words, your new subsection 2 would be the definition of quote, public servant in quotes, in Article Blank, shall apply to this section.
Yeah, and then read number the following.
Alright, you've heard the motion, all in favor of Mr. Chandler's amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Passed, and I think we've approved of Section 1 in its entirety. Okay, Section 5, Roger. Perjury and false statement.
Both the Sections 2 and 3, irregularities, no defense. It is no defense to a prosecution for perjury or false swearing that, one, the defendant was not competent for reasons other than mental disability or immaturity to make the false statement. Two, the statement was inadmissible under the rules of evidence. Three, the oath or affirmation was taken or administered in an irregular manner. And four, the defendant mistakenly believed the false statement to be immaterial.
What does all this mean? I just don't follow it all.
It means they can convict him for anything. They're out of defense anymore.
Well, this just takes away certain defenses from a defendant.
In another way, you're making it a strict liability crime.
Not necessarily. We're just taking away these particular defenses.
Do you have any other defenses other than the fact that the statement wasn't made? It was a matter of record.
It wasn't called.
A wife is the defendant not competent.
A wife testifying against her husband. She wasn't competent, but they let her testify anyway. She perjured herself in the fact that she wasn't competent. There's no defense. She could still be prosecuted.
Can you bring doctors into that too?
That's a question of privilege, not competency.
Well, some people would debate on that.
And I think I'm fine. Get rid of gang. Since we're considering the whole thing, one of the things we're doing in sub 2, as I read it, and this one, the rules of evidence, presume that at least the majority of the commission now knows what the rules of evidence are. They're subject to change without necessarily taking this matter into consideration. We'll be tying ourselves, we'll be tying down the.
I don't think it's a danger, because I think the purpose of this is that the guy says the light was red and he knows it's false and he knew it. He can't later defend on the ground that the judge shouldn't have let the evidence in.
Proper foundation with my lady.
Whatever. Trying to defend, but that technically it shouldn't have been admitted, but there wasn't any objection and so on and so forth, and it came in. Now, presumably that's as destructive of the hands of justice as a statement that is clearly admissible. I think that's all they're trying to do.
Well, the statement still, the reason for perjury has to be material.
Well, sure.
And it could very well be material, but why not have been admissible?
Well, but then you need to go to perjury or false swearing. Yeah. On the material. Chairman, I move to adopt Section 5.
2-3. Move Don, there's a motion, but under discussion.
Yeah, on the discussion on the motion now. With respect to someone now, this language, mental disability or immaturity. Now, mental disability, by that, now we're talking about responsibility. Now, there's a difference in the language there from what we use in our responsibility article. Professor Platt brought this up. If this is what we mean, that we should have it conform to the language mental disease or defect, excluding responsibility is the language we use in our responsibility article.
Well, I'm not sure that's right, Don, because
test of competency of a witness isn't necessarily the same as that of criminal responsibility.
No, it isn't, but we say for reasons other than mental disability.
Well, does our code presently prescribe that mental disability is a renders a witness incompetent?
I don't think it does.
I didn't recall that it did, but it may.
Here, Jim, this is easy to write for that.
Well,
chapter 44.
Well, 44.030 says the following persons are not competent witnesses. One, those of unsound mind at the time of their production to examination. And two, children under 10 years of age. Now, is there anybody else who is technically incompetent as a witness under our law? I don't think there is.
No, I don't think so.
Why do we need it then?
That's right. You're right. We were trying to talk about prison.
Husband and wife is terribly grounded.
Why do we need section one? You mean?
In no defense for prosecution for that the defendant was not competent.
Well, as a policy matter.
Well, I think Judge Burns' question is a good one. If mental disability and immaturity are the only two grounds of incompetency under our law, to say the defendant was not competent for reasons other than mental disability or immaturity is simply redundant and unnecessary, right?
Superfluous.
Sham,
well,
that's your point.
Yeah, unless you read something different between mental disability and unsound mind.
But do we want to make, as a policy matter, do we want to take somebody that is under a mental disability and isn't competent to testify and hold them responsible for perjury? So we're saying this.
No, we're not saying that.
If he's disabled, he doesn't.
He'd be insane.
We're saying he's incompetent for any other reason other than mental disability or immaturity.
Which means you still have the defense that is immaturity.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mental disability, a false claim.
But if the two exempted classes are the only classes of incompetent witnesses under Oregon law, and I assume you mean competent in a technical sense, then we're not accomplishing it.
Well, will this be retained in the procedural end? What you're saying is this other statute, or this other, the Oregon law will be retained in procedural end.
Well, I was reading from the civil definition of competent witnesses, and that's made applicable by chapter 139, I'm sure.
You don't mean, Roger, that I was a sloppy lawyer about competent.
I just wonder if really the reason that subsection 1 was in there was to say that it was a defense. And I think you put the poor way to do it.
Well, supposing though that assuming that these are the only two grounds on which a witness would be declared incompetent, what about the witness who is in fact incompetent, but the objection isn't raised at the time of trial, and he proceeds to testify and lie? Now, I'm not sure that the fact that we've got these two sections in our statutes.
Well, we have three sections.
Gets to the
139 on competence is a competency of certain witnesses, for example, a husband and wife.
Well, but notice what that says. That says that the defendant, at his own request, but not otherwise, is a competent witness. All that says is he's not a competent witness for the state to call. Well, it's state it's going to be calling him. The co-defendant is okay.
And I'm Charlie Porter.
Yeah. I thought maybe somebody would tell that story.
Well, I haven't heard.
What's that?
I don't know what the service did, but it was some
fracas down in Eugene. I don't know.
Well, it's apparently some civil rights thing. It
grew out of an altercation that took place up
there. Charlie was appointed as a special prosecutor. Yeah, and the first witness he called was the defendant.
And the reason was that the first defendant, the state had charged, allegedly had committed an assault and battery on this professor. So a complaint was authorized in the DA's office, and the guy was charged. And then he came in, and he wanted to charge the professor. And the district attorney's office wouldn't give him a complaint. So he went to the district court, and they authorized a complaint. And then the DA refused to prosecute. So the Charlie Porter asked the judge to appoint a special prosecutor, and the judge said, all right, you're appointed. So he appointed Charlie Porter. So in the trial, in which the original complainant was in defense, Charlie Porter called the defendant as his witness and was mistried.
Didn't happen to a better guy.
I'd ask him, I said, I want a horrible story about part of the lawsuit.
Well, the other section says that in all criminal actions in which the husband is the party accused, the wife is a competent witness, and the wife is a party accused, the husband is a competent witness, but neither husband nor wife in such cases shall be compelled or allowed to testify unless by consent of both of them. Now, that is not saying that they're incompetent.
It's a privilege.
It's like a privilege. So even in chapter 139, we don't have any, other than the defendant, we don't have anybody who isn't competent as a witness, other than unsound mind or under 10 years of age.
And this can be deleted.
Well,
I actually,
because we're setting up two different standards.
Yeah, we either make it conform or kick it out.
So move, Mr. Chairman.
You move to kick out sub one, huh? Okay, you've heard the motion.
Well, excuse me, may I have one other thing? I assume, however, that the common law rule was and would still be the law in Oregon, that incompetency for either of these reasons would be a defense, even though we take out subsection one.
Oh, I think so.
Sure, because the defendant who perjured himself would be charged with a crime, and obviously responsible for any utility or defenses to the crime. So I have no doubt that it's going to be defensible.
I think we have a motion before us to approve the whole section.
I'm sure
it's been withdrawn, and Mr. Johnson moves to amend section 5 by striking sub 1. All in favor, say aye as your name is called. Those opposed, no.
Judge Burns?
Aye.
Carson?
Aye.
Chandler?
Aye.
Clark?
Aye.
Ross? Claus?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Knight?
Aye.
Young?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion carries. What's your pleasure?
I move to renumber the sections and approve the section as amended.
Okay, you've heard the motion. All in favor of the motion, say aye as your name is called. Yes,
I'll bring up one point.
You bet.
We had a letter from the mayor that came up with the subcommittee. In the situation where, say, in a criminal case, say, make some deposition for taking the witness, and the witness testifies under oath. And then subsequently it's a trial, they send witnesses on the witness stand, and they testify contrary to the previous form of testimony. And there are statutes, apparently, right now, that where the witness can, what you call it, retract prior testimony and testify without endangering themselves to the subject of the penalty of perjury. Probably the argument being that this encourages the final truth to come out of the trial and places the witness in a replaces, takes away the premium on consistency. Over and above, perhaps, what this can be.
Yeah, some of it.
But I also, but the statutes are drawn so that you make that retraction before you're hit with the inconsistency, if I recall correctly, isn't that right? We do it any way we want it.
There are a couple of different approaches to it. Now, Michigan, for example, requires you to retract the same proceeding.
Yeah.
That's one approach. And.
Or decisions reached on that.
Yeah. And the subcommittee, we had this in the draft to start with.
This is it here.
Now, well, why don't you go ahead and go over that? Tell them how it read, the original section.
Model Penal Code section reads, retraction. No person shall be guilty of an offense under this section, that would be perjury, if he retracted the falsification in the course of the proceeding in which it was made, before it became manifest that the falsification was or would be exposed, and before the falsification substantially affected the proceedings. A similar provision has been adopted by the states of Michigan, Illinois, and New York. In other words, all the New York and Michigan court provisions, they took it almost verbatim from the Model Penal Code. That's contrary to the common law, which holds that perjury once committed cannot be purged, even by a correction during the same hearing. And it's contrary to the most recent Supreme Court, which isn't too recent, 1937. The Supreme Court didn't like that idea, stating, the argument overlooks the tendency of such a view to encourage false swearing and the belief that if the falsity be not discovered before the end of the hearing, it will have its intended effect. But if discovered, the witness may purge himself of crime by resuming his role as a witness and substituting the truth for his previous falsehood. But the Model Penal Code felt that it would preserve an incentive to correct falsehoods without impairing the compulsion to tell the truth in the first place.
Now this comes up in our later section where you have two sworn statements that are contradictory. And the argument is that that in some cases where the sworn statement's been transcribed, that the witness can be certainly advised prior to trial, you better damn well stick to your story. Because if you don't, one of these statements is false.
You can argue both ways. If you have a retraction statement, there's some truth in that Supreme Court argument. You can always take a chance on lying now because it looks like you're going to be found out. You can always get back in the stand. The other side of the coin would be that it would, to some extent, in the absence of a retraction statement, it would encourage you to keep lying. In other words, once having lied, you're going to almost have to stay with it. Because if you admit it, you're going to be charged with perjury.
Well, of course, that presumes that the only testimony that would be your own. Because if you stick with your story and they can prove that you weren't there, an alibi, for instance, then you can stick with your story all you want. You're going to nail for perjury. The only, I say, a small segment is the one that Harl brings up, really, where you get a guy on one day lying, intentionally misrepresenting the material fact on one hand, and then at some subsequent time flip-flopping and intentionally misrepresenting a fact again. Because then you get the conflict.
Except that if he initially lies, it's certainly lies.
Well, now,
he initially lies without this protection, he's going to be guilty of perjury if he tells the truth.
No, he's not going to be guilty of perjury if they're going to prove it. That's a difference.
Let's say it's the only way, let's say the fact that he is of his knowledge alone, and he lies. Let's say it's a situation where he's a co-defendant, this is coming out. He lies. Then the trial of his co-defendant, the light hits him and he decides he wants to tell the truth. Co-defendant would be a good example, but he wants to tell the truth. He's going to be guilty of perjury. He doesn't then take the stand and in fact tell the truth.
Well, I think that the district attorney would take a strong look at him if he initially lied to guilty, and then he subsequently switches his story so he becomes innocent. I think we would, Frank, take a pretty good look at him.
Especially the district attorney's office.
Yeah. All right.
Well, I... That process...
So that's why it ties into the subsequent, ties in here as a defense, but it ties into the subsequent.
It's interesting. To me, it's a relationship that's not too far removed from what we discussed at lunch about the contraction statutes that were liable. Somehow, if you say, I retract it, unring the bell and pronounce absolution. And I think it's unique that here we're sitting around. I can see the wisdom of it, but I...
Of course you don't pronounce absolution. Pronounce absolution.
But the model penal code section seems to create too many problems in instruction.
No,
if you can prove damage, if you can prove damage, you can collect regardless of the traffic.
Especially from my reputation.
Even damage to reputation.
I'd like to hear about Jim.
What do you think of, Jim?
Look.
Harold wants to hear what you think.
It's another retraction situation.
I don't know. I don't have any strong thoughts about it.
Well, that was pretty much the end of the subcommittee. No one had any strong thoughts about it. You know, not particularly, but we felt that we should let the commission discuss the question.
Well, I think Roger explained it pretty well. I mean, there are two sides to it, and there are compelling reasons in favor of either side. There's certainly a compelling reason to make people come forward and change their story and tell the truth. But it's interesting to note the Model Penal Code has that, but. No, none of the states have adopted it, am I right?
They have.
They have.
Michigan, New York.
They
Illinois.
All have.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Does this tie in any way with pronunciation, Donald? Does pronunciation mean that would be only in court crimes?
Yeah, either in the court crimes or in the connection with the accomplice.
And you wouldn't really?
Yes. Most things you get are from a retraction situation where the guy has already been found out. And this retraction thing only applies if he comes forward before he's been...
Before he's exposed.
Before the thing is exposed. And the only time I think the person might come forward and say that I lied before he was exposed was when he'd been more or less honestly mistaken when he lied in the first place.
And they've been covered.
And that's not perjury anyway. But then he might come forward and say, well, now look, I was sure that was wrong on this. But then he might honestly come forward and say, he would be charged with perjury anyway. But if a person is really lying, they're not going to come forward with the truth until you've got the goods on them and they know they're going to be found out. And then they might.
Then they got to kind of like kick the can. If you beat the DA back to the judge, you can be absolved.
Yeah. If you get on the stand, doesn't put you back on the stand before the
testimony
comes out.
Maybe we could drag in the library.
Maybe we can discuss it in regard. The reason that disturbed me was in regard to subsequent sessions we had where what the subcommittee recommended was that if you prove that it's been one sworn testimony, it's been another one, and they're contrary, and that's all the state's got to prove. And then it goes to the jury. I don't know.
Notwithstanding the fact that he may later have recanted.
No, I think...
Well, it's what he pretended, that they got the second statement, you see.
That's right.
That's what they got, well, the second statement.
What I mean is, the substantive section, again, just ties down that we're putting a premium section consistency. Section 7 says...
Well, for example, the New York statute says, in any prosecution for perjury, it is an affirmative defense that the defendant retracted his false statement in the course of the proceeding in which it was made, before such false statement substantially affected the proceeding, and before it became manifest that his falsity was or would be exposed.
That's not your situation, Harold. That's not your situation. You're talking about a... inconsistent statements made at two different times.
Well,
like in a deposition and trial, or like in a preliminary hearing in a jury trial or a grand jury. And
Section 7 can protect that. As I read it, fine, you can have a guy saying one thing for a grand jury, another thing at trial, and that's all. He's guilty of perjury. You don't have to prove that either of the statements was false, but there's a mere fact that they're inconsistent. One of them had to be false, which is pretty logical. And, what Carl's suggestion, if I understand it, is that he makes a false statement in the grand jury. He's called to trial and says, I made a false statement in the grand jury because of error or something else, because I was mistaken. Corrects him on the trial before the time he caught up on it.
Yeah, the Michigan statute is broader and would go to pretrial statements. For example, if you lied in a deposition and the trial didn't come up for 4 or 5 months, then you could retract the trial. It would be a defense to perjury charge.
I can see such things as in the same proceeding. We have to be, to me, pretrial is not necessarily the same proceeding.
Yeah, so they deal with that specifically. Somebody's getting statements made in separate hearings.
Unless the guy's
just
mistaken.
Well, the point that you bring up, Harold, you bring it up in objection to the motion that was before us when you brought it up, or...
Well, we were getting ready to have a motion to move on to 5.
Yeah, we had a motion to approve 5 as amended.
And I thought I should bring it up because this is dealing with the defenses for the perjury charge.
That's where it
would
go in.
And that's where it would go in. And I don't know if I have any strong feelings or convictions on it, but without it, it does seem that we recognize an inherent problem of using it, but it does seem to place a premium on consistency. But I can see also where another viewpoint that we, when someone committed an initial act of perjury, we're giving them a chance to walk away from it. I just kind of worry about the trial situation where you, including Frank, of course, this attorney might have a witness maybe 2 months after initially making some statement to the judge, and he's saying, well, look here, on the basis of your statement, we took this to grand jury, we indicted you. This is coming from all over the state. We've got a trial here starting tomorrow. Now you tell me that you're going to. I'm going to tell you. We don't really like it.
So you already have some witnesses and you're paying for perjury in the first place.
You wouldn't if we had this.
Sure, you can be with the punch.
Well,
he has to make the second statement.
We're talking about the witness that comes in and says, look, I said that, but I thought about it.
Well, let me ask you this.
He doesn't say a lie.
I understand, Carl. That's
the point. If he does come in ahead, it's because somebody's getting pretty close to home. But Frank's at the point. Usually he won't say that on the stand. That's my point.
Well,
Tilly gets a call.
It seems to be one of them.
He doesn't come in the day before. I said that, but it's not quite true when you point out. It's when he gets on the stand.
Well, you've got another situation, though, it seems to me, too. You've got the individual who, say, lies before the grand jury and then later has pangs of conscience or, you know, wants to fess up and tell the truth. And so he retracts. But you also could have a situation of retraction, not because the guy wants to tell the truth, but because on cross-examination somebody's getting to him and he finally just caves in and says, all right, I lied when I said that.
Now, are we going to allow that kind of retraction to be a defense?
Or he comes into the courtroom,
then that boils down to the basic action. Question. That boils down to the basic question. What's most important, getting the truth out of the witness?
Well, let me compound it by saying you have to assume always that the first statement he made is false, and that he would never be caused to make a second statement that's false. Well, suppose his first statement is true, and then under withering testimony or cross-examination, he says, all right, you're right.
Have it your way.
I was wrong, the first one, and I admit it, and I want absolution, and now he is guilty. I think there's just as equal
that's
chance
not,
for...
I don't think that's equal chance,
I think is a wild example of dealing not with honest mistakes. We're dealing now, we're down with the thieves. We're trying to argue how to make a man who has lied, who has perjured himself, make him moral, make him truthful. And I don't disagree with Harl that the claim to consistency is not good, but to look at Michigan and the model penal code as examples of how to get, if as I say, it's like Wintag, if the perjurer can beat the DA back to the judge and confess it, he's all right, but if the DA finds it first and becomes material and manifests that he lied, he doesn't even get the absolution that we're talking about.
But if you leave out this chance to perjure yourself and then go on and pass number 7, section 7 of this draft, then you're really forcing him to lie all the way. Because then, if he makes a sworn statement here and a sworn statement here and it's inconsistent, that's all you got to prove, is that he made it, and read them to the jury and let the jury know that they were inconsistent, and off he goes to the podium. You don't have to do anything except prove that on the face of it they were made and that they're inconsistent.
But isn't it not true that what you need, in the cases, the only time this would work is when you have nothing else, and he has nothing else to go on, and he has to use the individual's own statement to catch him on. Because if he can prove the perjury any other way, he doesn't, the heck with the retraction statute, the heck with the inconsistent statements, he's got him lying. Wow. So you hone
easiest
it down
way
to
prove it. The easiest way to prove it, if you got it, is two sworn statements. That would seem to me to be the simplest way for a DA to go in and pass around a Xerox of this statement and a Xerox of that statement, right here,
yes,
it'll match.
All right, but that's Section 7. That's not Section 5. Maybe we ought to hold a special defense
to
Section 7.
I mean, but the point is being made, as I understand it, that if we adopt Harl's suggestion, what we're doing is letting a guy who lied get off the hook by changing his mind and telling the truth at some later time.
Yeah, and then after it's already affected the outcome of...
Yeah, my point is that unless you do that, you're forcing him to stick with a lie all the time, and you'll never get him to change his story. When presumably, he's going to lie the first time and more likely tell the truth the second.
Why would he tell the second truth the second time? If the only testimony the DA had would be the guy's testimony himself, why would he be quiet?
You've seen people change their mind and do it.
Yeah, but I haven't heard anybody jump up and say, well, that was perjury before.
No, but have you ever heard someone say, now, Mr. Witness, you are aware, are you not, of the penalty of perjury? And you see on redirect examination,